You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B, and this issue covers 2 months, December 2025 and January 2026. Here's the continuation of The People's Princes, compiled by Otessa Marshfeg, with photos by Theo Winner. Now, this from Anna Peel, Jonathan Bailey, The Triple Threat. Jonathan Bailey has chemistry with seemingly anyone and anything. Matt Bomer in the decades spanning romance Fellow Travelers, Simone Ashley on Shonda Rhimes' insanely popular bodice ripper Bridgerton, practically all of Oz as crooning, soft-shoeing Pharaoh in Wicked, a Mosasaur in this summer's Jurassic World Rebirth. "I know that people acknowledge me as charming," he says. "I feel quite kooky." That ethos is reflected in Bailey's personal leading man pantheon, which includes Gene Wilder, Jim Carrey, and Robin Williams, versatile clowns whose work has a vivid, sometimes tragic dimension. "I feel like there's just this brilliant sort of throbbing orb that's to be reclaimed from those incredible performances," he says. Of course, it had to be throbbing. As a kid in Oxfordshire, England, Bailey learned the art of being publicly enchanting from his three older sisters, who taught him dances they'd seen while with friends or out clubbing, and then made him perform them for the family. "I was a sort of tiny little Shetland pony that was being broken into dressage," the actor jokes. He'll enjoy even more audience adoration with a return to Bridgerton and Wicked for good. But there's one place he does not seek connection. "I hate group chats," Bailey says, twice requesting that this information be published in Vanity Fair. That and tepid baths. Keziah Weir writes about the Method Man, Austin Butler. "It's one thing to win hearts as a heroic World War II pilot. As a black-toothed psychopath, it's a little harder. But whether swaying in Masters of the Air or deploying a devilish wink during a Dune Part II fight to the death, Austin Butler manages. Off-screen, he's a famously shy person whose interest in others and powerful eye contact reads as charisma. 'I want to know about you,' he tells an interviewer, wearing a white tee that does the same thing for him as it did for Robert Redford and James Dean. A consummate California boy, Butler grew up between Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm and got his start playing heartthrobs on YATV before tipping toward darkness in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. His career shows that total immersion, once a macho pursuit, can be a hallmark of true devotion. After 2022's Elvis, he spent months shaking the accent that earned him an Oscar nomination. 'I used to think that in order to be a great artist, I had to destroy the rest of my life,' he says. 'It's this fear that my own experience, my own emotions, my own soul isn't enough.' These days, he's stripping back for roles like Zoe Kravitz's tortured former ballplayer boyfriend and Darren Aronofsky's gritty crime caper caught stealing. High on his wish list is a part like Ryan Gosling's in Blue Valentine, one that explores the complexities of two people coming together and falling in love. In other words, charm and everything underneath." Daniela Tijerina writes on The Toast of Texas, Glenn Powell. "Only the most capable leading man can hold audiences in the palm of his hand, even when he's playing a dick, as the square-jawed, gym-cut Glenn Powell so often does. He's embodied charming alphas in box office hits, like Anyone But You and Twisters, while proving his screenwriting chops with Hitman and the Hulu series Chad Powers. Powell's secret is simple. A warm smile, unexpected self-awareness. He knows he's beautiful, but he knows you know too. And good old-fashioned grind. The reality is, I've never considered myself to be the most talented person, he says, but I knew that no one would ever outwork me. Even years after he ground his way onto the A-list, Powell, speaking with his fluffy pup, Brisket, lying in his lap, seems genuinely starstruck by his own career. He's just as excited to be here, on a film set, on a red carpet, or in a movie theater, as we are to see him. And for that, the consummate Southern gentleman issues heartfelt thanks. If somebody wants a selfie and they're like, "Hey, my mom's over there. She's embarrassed to talk to you. Can you go say hi?" I will walk across that restaurant, he says. I'll go say hi to your mom. I'll make a birthday video for whoever. Though really, he'd much rather talk shop and keep his eyes on the future. I hope I get to do this job until I die, he says, with utter sincerity before pausing to clarify, which I hope is at an old age, fingers crossed. I love this job. Chris Murphy writes on The Old Soul, Michael B. Jordan. Man, I'm born in 87, Michael B. Jordan says with a world-weary laugh, but being a Dragon Ball Z-loving elder millennial has its benefits. In his teens and 20s, the Newark-raised actor learned to ply his trade in genres that are now practically extinct. Soaps like All My Children and prestige dramas like The Wire and Friday Night Lights. He became a household name after Fruitvale Station, a film that positions Jordan as the rational evolution of the traditional stoic hero, one that was made right before casting directors began to care more about Instagram followers than raw talent. That heart-wrenching drama also happened to be Jordan's first movie with the man he calls Coog, Ryan Coogler, the Scorsese to Jordan's De Niro. In interviews, Jordan uses the language of self-improvement and emotional regulation, therapy speak as masculine poetry. Coogler's highly commercial auteurism perfectly complements Jordan's old-fashioned movie star aura. Their mind meld has given us the Creed franchise, about the inheritance of pain, the way strength can contain tenderness without apology, as well as the Black Panther films and Sinners. Yet despite their record, we've been underestimated, Jordan says. Nobody should make that mistake with Jordan's upcoming reimagining of suave crime flick, The Thomas Crown Affair, which feels newly relevant following October's Louvre heist. Though the original came out in 1968, Jordan naturally has a soft spot for the 1999 remake starring Pierce Brosnan. Maybe his take will inspire Jen Alpha's answer to Michael B. Jordan. Savannah Walsh writes on The Guy Next Door, Callum Turner. There's a disarming normalcy to Callum Turner, whose inward gaze and hesitant charm channel a kind of erotic modesty. Unpresuming but cheeky, Turner speaks so casually that it takes a beat to realize when he talks about texting with Daniel, he means Day Lewis. Turner is buddies with the 3-time Oscar winner, who's given the younger actor invaluable advice. Dance to the rhythm of your own beat. If you want to be a soap star, be a soap star. If you want to be in franchise movies, be in franchise movies. It's your personal journey. Raised by a single mom in working-class London, Turner established himself as a successful model before heeding his mentor's advice. Graduating from charming, supporting bloke to leading man status in sober period pieces like Masters of the Air and The Boys in the Boat. Perhaps Turner's humble beginnings explain the grounded quality he exudes even when talking about his high-profile engagement to Grammy-winning pop star Dua Lipa. There's nothing hard about it at all, he says, when asked about navigating a public romance, though his rosy cheeks suggest otherwise. It's the easiest thing in the world. It really is. Turner prefers to stay off social media and out of the spotlight. He withholds not out of control, but care. Still, He'd like to clear up one headline. He and Lipa have no current plans to relocate. There's lots of things that pop up saying we're going to buy a house. Are you going to buy a house somewhere in Spain? That came up yesterday, he says. That's pretty outlandish. The same could be said for two high-concept 2025 films starring Turner, Mark Jenkins' meditative Rose of Nevada and A24's Eternity, in which Turner portrays the embodiment of the perfect man. He's far too unassuming to admit he fits the type. From Julie Miller, the auteur Harris Dickinson. Harris Dickinson is shirtless and slow dancing to George Michael's father figure in the most talked-about scene of Baby Girl, the 2024 film that catapulted the Brit from Cannes Film Festival breakout to full-fledged internet obsession. Though the film's about a BDSM relationship, he isn't performing dominance here. He's radiant, embodied, free. Dickinson is feeling himself, and we feel him feeling himself. Even more impressive, he's magnetic enough to sell the idea that Nicole Kidman would risk her high-powered career and marriage to Antonio Banderas all for him. The improvised sequence was so sexy that it inspired a TikTok frenzy, a Pedro Pascal tribute, and at least one lusty article titled, "Be Our Father Figure, Harris." This year, Dickinson made an even greater leap, premiering his feature directorial debut, Urchin, to rave reviews and a standing ovation at Cannes. The applause was somewhat mortifying for Dickinson, who's more comfortable on or behind a camera than in a theater as himself. "I can hide between action and cut," he says. Dickinson is as modest about his charms as he is about these public displays of attention, only acknowledging that he can consciously enchant a specific demographic. "I'm good with old people if I need to be," he says with a wily smile. That population might be particularly primed for Dickinson in his highest profile role yet, John Lennon and Sam Mendes' Beatles biopics. After months of preparation, there's still something about the Fab Four's frontman that seems enigmatic, says Dickinson. "I don't know if I'll ever feel like I've fully figured him out. Maybe a slow dance with his on-screen Yoko Ono, Anna Sawai, will be the key." Joe Hagan writes on the maverick Lakeith Stanfield. Like an apparition, Lakeith Stanfield appears from behind a column. Tall and rangy, in a Yankees cap and Gucci loafers, a sly expression on his face. It's a perfectly Lakeith Stanfield moment. Delightful and a little creepy. An echo of his role as André, the haunted character from Jordan Peele's Get Out, probably the movie most responsible for putting Stanfield on the map. "I've always been mischievous," he tells me. "I think that's what I like about characters, too. It's like finding little things about them that are just off of what was there on the page." Lakeith gravitated to drama class in high school and landed his first role in a 2008 short that was later made into a feature film called Short Term 12, co-starring other future A-listers like Rami Malek and Brie Larson. Best known for the head trips Sorry to Bother You and Atlanta, he brings his peculiar presence to other critically acclaimed projects in 2025, appearing alongside Channing Tatum in Roofman and with Jennifer Lawrence in Die, My Love. Next year, he will star in a new movie by Sorry auteur Boots Riley, I Love Boosters. Stanfield won't reveal much about it, except to say it's one of the craziest things I've ever played. Looking ahead, he's hungry for more complex and riskier roles. He wants to play a well-written villain, he says, like Heath Ledger's in The Dark Knight, or Bryan Cranston's in Breaking Bad. Says Stanfield, "I love a cunning character that's always plotting on something that other people don't really know he's plotting. We've noticed." From John Ross, the philosopher, Riz Ahmed. Riz Ahmed's fans think he lives in America, an assumption he's happy not to correct. The Oscar winner proudly calls himself a hermit, though as we speak, he's openly strolling through a park in his native London. Anyone who's paying attention can hear him explain how he considers the internet a necessary evil. When social media comes up, the actor and rapper delivers a line with the precision of someone who's workshopped this thought, perhaps too carefully. I never scroll, but Ahmed still has to promote his projects online, using the same internet that has, on occasion, accused him of being part of the Illuminati. When Ahmed posts about his wife, his identity, or his work, the gesture feels studied but sincere, like a poem pretending not to be one. His performances and projects like Sound of Metal and The Night Of are exercises in precision, men whose vulnerability is framed by intellect. In person, too, he marries theory to passion, politics to compassion. Though he admires Tom Cruise, his co-star in Alejandro G. Iñárritu's upcoming Warner Brothers film, Ahmed is less of a showman than his colleague. He's measured, earnest, thoughtful. It's no surprise that he lists Denzel Washington, Jackie Chan, and Irfan Khan as three actors who have inspired him for vastly different reasons. Washington is unapologetically himself, says Ahmed. Chan has put forward a complicated and layered mold of manhood. Khan, meanwhile, was one of the first actors to truly bridge East and West. What connects the three is that they didn't fit the mold. Neither does Ahmed. Rebecca Ford writes on the strong sensitive type, Andrew Garfield. Earlier this year, on a press tour for Luca Guadagnino's After the Hunt, Andrew Garfield fielded a jarringly inappropriate question about hashtag MeToo and Black Lives Matter by quietly shifting his body toward his co-stars Julia Roberts and Ayo Edebiri, smiling faintly, while instinctively deferring to the women beside him. That's what sets the two-time Oscar nominee apart. Not his classically handsome looks or puckish allure, but his profound emotional intelligence. Whether he's slinging webs as Spider-Man, wrestling with his face, with his faith in silence, or teaching Elmo how to cope with grief, he brings an extraordinary sensitivity to every role. After the Hunt, which cast Garfield as a professor accused of sexual assault, challenges him to play against type, pushing him further than ever before. That really felt scary, he says. I've not really played a part that has the darkness this person has. For his next trick, Garfield delves into another appealingly complicated man. 15 years after he found fame portraying Facebook co-founder Eduardo Severin in The Social Network, Garfield is returning to the tech world with Guadagnino's new film Artificial. As embattled OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, Garfield took the role because he's curious and cautious about the people leading us into what they call an inevitable future. He finds that certainty fascinating. I'm very curious about people who have the self-delusion, maybe self-belief, that they're the ones that should run the world. Joy Press writes on The Heartbreaker, Paul Mescal, a beige T-shirt pockmarked with holes, gently mussed bedhead, a sheepish smile. This is Paul Mescal's ordinary guy armor. Since catapulting to fame in the pandemic-era sensation Normal People, the Irish actor has cornered the market in approachable-looking characters with tortured souls. His characters seem to leak emotion through their pores. In projects like that Sally Rooney adaptation and After Sun, he gives us male suffering so delicate it feels like grace. We don't just watch Mescal, we ache for him. Mescal is currently promoting Chloe Zhao's emotionally devastating Hamnet while preparing to play Paul McCartney in Sam Mendes' Beatles movies. But soon, he hopes to move past characters who radiate varying degrees of sadness, even if those magnetically melancholy roles are the very parts that have earned him a fervent following. He felt particularly uncomfy about the way he was objectified when normal people's sex scenes shot to the top of streaming queues across the globe, he says, and is currently determined to keep his romantic life private. A pivot from the days when his Twitter flirtation with musician Phoebe Bridgers blossomed into a lengthy relationship before the public's eyes. I am grateful to the people that care about the work I do, but I can't care too deeply about the people who don't, Mescal says. Which is a white lie, he confesses with a wink, putting his head in his hands. That's a permanent fixture in my therapy session. Why doesn't everybody love me? From Case Wickman, The Contrarian, Jeremy Allen White. Jeremy Allen White is not a brooding native son of Chicago, a brooding juvenile delinquent and science prodigy, or a brooding superstar musician. In fact, he's not even Jeremy Allen White. The Emmy-winning star of culinary pressure cooker The Bear, the long-running family dramedy Shameless, and this year's Boss biopic Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, uses his middle name professionally only because when he registered with the Screen Actors Guild, there had already been another Jeremy White in the union. That's not how I understand myself, White says. When he hears himself addressed by all three names, it does feel like people are talking about someone I don't know. So, who is White? Coming up in the business, he looked up to, and in interviews, sometimes consciously imitated, Sean Penn. When Calvin Klein cast him in its spring 2024 underwear campaign, it was less about abs than aura. He was giving the fantasy of the emotionally overworked man who still texts back. Now, at 34, he's just happy that by the time The Bear launched him into a new stratosphere of fame, he was already fully cooked as a person. I don't need to put on any self-serious or troubled attitudes. He knows he seems intense, but he claims that, too, is not the real Jeremy White. As if to prove it, he makes a joke. I'm allowed to smile, although I won't do it very often. And Dan Adler writes on the virtuoso A$AP Rocky. As a Harlem rapper mixing street tales with Rick Owens and Rafe Simons, A$AP Rocky cultivated a unique persona, flamboyant, insouciant, all clever wordplay, and soaring cheekbones. Today, he speaks his own language, tending toward what could be called Rockyisms, affably serious proclamations of his own charisma and good looks. Acting is just another component of the great arts, he says, squinting one early evening in the Los Angeles sun. And I'm a Renaissance man. Rocky's next phase is less a pivot than a fresh application of some immutable, sumptuous essence. He's leaned way into film work, taking on meaty roles in the parenting drama If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and Spike Lee's crime thriller Highest to Lowest. Off-screen, his third child with his co-star in Domestic Bliss, Rihanna, was born shortly after he shot Vanity Fair's cover, a girl he and his superstar partner named Rocky Irish. As soon as I got off set, he says, I had some really great news. Rocky also co-chaired the Met Gala less than 3 months after his acquittal in a felony assault trial, where his courtroom suits were hotly anticipated by Instagram commentators. He practically walks red carpets with a stroller. Who doesn't love that kind of confidence? Rocky knows that fashion is fickle and that he won't be king forever, but he isn't mourning yet. After me, it'll be somebody special, and hopefully I know who that person is, and it'll be a person who I feel like deserves it. World on Fire, Olivia Nuzzi was a star political correspondent until scandal led her into exile and to a California up in flames. In an excerpt from American Canto, our West Coast editor takes stock of scorched earth. Opening photo is a piece of artwork, portrait by Isabel Berman, How to Disappear, 2025. I woke the morning after Election Day on the wrong coast of the right country. A brush fire had come charging across the road, through two houses, and onto the cliffs above the sea. But I did not know that yet. All I knew was that my phone was ringing, and when I picked up, it was a friend walking along the Atlantic in Palm Beach, where I was supposed to be, and she was dodging sources and subjects, like I was supposed to be. And when the conversation turned to a sensitive topic, right around the time I was wondering why my coffee was not brewing, the call dropped. The power was out. A few minutes later, the planes swooped down to spray the flames in the bluffs. I watched from the Pacific Coast Highway, as far away from my problems as I could get on land, which was not far enough. You cannot outrun your life on fire. On the coast, the street lights and traffic lights and the lights in the big windows of the big houses turned to black. It was not until I made my way up to Zuma that I saw the fire had been right behind me. The pink clouds puffed up to the south, then the flames peaked over the hill. The sky grew lighter as the fire swelled and made its way to the sea. I watched from the deck as the night turned orange. How many, like the rattlesnake, his little soul swallowed without ceremony in one breath? And where would the coyotes go? They did not walk across the deck and leap into the garden tonight. 12:40 a.m., 100 acres burning. I stand on the edge of the earth. I wander through the burned-up grasslands. Any fantasy of creation I understand as a fantasy of destruction, too, and every spark of life an ember of death, a trillion little deaths a minute, collecting quickly around your ankles, tethering you to the beach, dividing you from the sea. Off the cliff, over the Mediterranean, and on to the cliff over the Pacific. 2:15 a.m., 850 acres burning. As a child, I became convinced that death was not random, that life was the process of investigating what the point of it was. And as soon as you figured it out, in that very instant, you would ascend. God would eliminate you from this plane. He would not risk a leaker walking among the ignorant. The assignment was to crack the case for yourself. And when I would find myself thinking too hard about the central question, I would back away, slowly thinking, well, I will return to this matter some other time when I feel more ready to possibly meet my end. What if I guessed correctly? The unsolvable puzzle. Tripping once on a balcony in Washington overlooking the National Cathedral, smoking what I did not know was my final cigarette. Unless someone offers me a Capri, which does not count. The great cosmic riddle. I figured I had solved it. The joke was that the joke was never done being told. 4 a.m., 1,800 acres burning. The wildfire is over my shoulder now, over the hill. The waxing gibbous moon is over my head. A thought bubble. It shines blankly. Across the country, the politician is the guest of honor. Across the country with his wife, with Mike Tyson for some reason. People are mocking the photos, asking where I am, asking how she could stand there after all that. I know how. The earth here is hot. Inside the bonfire, what evidence can I burn? I think of all I turned to ash in hotel rooms, I think of how you cannot burn a cloud. I think of the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, how there were so many, how the officials did not know what to do with them, and how fire seldom seemed to occur, though the White House and the President's properties are studded with fireplaces. Too easy. I worry. I worry about evil. If it is a force, if it is like the Santa Ana winds, if it may come on suddenly, if it may grab hold, if it may depart, but not completely, if it may leave word, if the word might sound good, if I might again believe it. The snake charmer, the man-eater, the devil himself. Was it ever a question that where there was a cloak there would be a dagger? A friend told me once, never trust anyone wearing a lapel pin. This politician did not wear one of those. Midnight, 3,000 acres burning. A politician's greatest trick is to convince you that he is not one. And what is a politician? Any man who wants to be loved more than other men and through his pursuit reveals why he cannot love himself. People ask me now about anger, about my lack of it. How could I not be enraged? I think this over. I scan the terrain of my body, my chest, my spine, behind my belly button. I look for pale pulses of idle fury, waiting for the alarm to sound at the tripwire of my veins. There's nothing there. There's nothing there because I loaded a gun. I loaded a gun and set it on my nightstand. You cannot live in America without thinking about guns, without thinking that one day you might not live anymore in America, and the reason will be a gun. 46,728 lives ended in America in 2023 because of a gun. 27,300 suicides. 17,927 homicides. 604 police shootings. 463 accidents. 434 undetermined. On the 405, a billboard announces that gun injuries are the number one cause of death for American children. You think, a gun will protect me from guns. Then you recall the statistic that a gun in your home doubles your chances of dying by homicide. Still, I loaded a gun. I loaded a gun and set it on my nightstand. I could blame all who reached for it, who fired in my direction, who dove as it fell to the floor, who fought to wrest control of it, who rose to stand over me, who emptied the barrel into the parts of me that seemed still alive. But the violence began with the act that preceded the shots and the struggle. It began when I loaded a gun and set it on my nightstand. I loaded a gun. I would take a bullet for you, the politician said. He always said that. Please don't say that, I said. I always said that. From his mouth, the bullet theoretical launched the bullet possible. I did not like to think about it, about the armed man at his speech, or the armed man who broke into his home, or the armed men he paid to guard him from armed men who sought to harm him, while the federal government denied his pleas for protection from the security agency whose modern protocols were carved by the same bullets that cut boughs from his family tree and cut the track of the American experiment. I did not like to think about it, just as later I would not like to think about the worm in his brain that other people found so funny. I loved his brain. I hated the idea of an intruder therein. Others thought he was a madman. He was not quite mad the way they thought, but I loved the private ways that he was mad. I loved that he was insatiable in all ways, as if he would swallow up the whole world just to know it better if he could. He made me laugh, but I winced when he joked about the worm. Baby, don't worry, he said. It's not a worm. A doctor he trusted had reviewed the scans of his brain obtained by the New York Times, he said, and concluded that the shadowy figure was likely not a parasite at all. He sighed. It was too late to interfere with what had already vaulted from the sphere of meme to the sphere of screwy legend. But at least I did not have to worry about the worm that was not a worm in his brain. In Volcanoes National Park, no cell reception, except just over there, at the top of the slope of rock, for a few seconds. Long enough for the veil of paradise to be pierced by the bullet literal that had flown in Butler right at the president's head. The politician left the Midwest for the East Coast. The deal with the president had fallen through. The moon was big and gold, and we marveled at this. I do pay attention to the moon, he told me once. We had been born under the same kind of moon, the January waxing gibbous in Capricorn, 97% illumination, 39 years apart. Do you think this means we're compatible, he asked me. I don't know, I said. Maybe. Next photo, Olivia Nuzzi in Malibu. The spark, the flame, the rumor fulfilled, the labyrinth on fire, the Palisades fire. 10:30 a.m., 10 acres burning. 10:50 a.m., 20 acres burning. The winds returned at what was described by officials as a hurricane force of 80 miles per hour. It had been in Southern California, not just a drought, but the driest nine-month period in recorded history. Billions of dollars to fund fleets of hundreds of fire trucks and aircraft and thousands of responders, plus the thousands more volunteers and furloughed prisoners paid as little as $1 an hour for their labor, up against our more flammable world. 2 p.m., 700 acres burning. 3 p.m., 1,300 acres burning. Past hairpin turns, down canyon roads to the shore, firefighters threw up barriers, knocked on the car windows of people as they tried to flee, advised that there would not be time for traffic jams near the highway. Wildfire is a sprinter. Flames grow as fast as 3 acres a second. Wildfire wins every race. Survival would require quick acceptance here. Escapees would need to abandon their cars, their belongings, and exit the disaster on foot. Wives prepared, husbands forgot. What they recalled mostly was the good generic day before the burning began. I had a bowl of apples, one man said. I gave her some apples. His wife closed her eyes and smiled. He gave me some apples. By nightfall, the winds had grounded the helicopters. The fire swelled. 12:30 a.m., 3,000 acres burning. 9 a.m., 5,000 acres burning. 11:45 a.m., 12,000 acres burning. 1:30 p.m., 16,000 acres burning. New fires broke out elsewhere, everywhere, in the Hollywood Hills near Runyon, in Altadena, north in Ventura, south in Orange, all of Southern California painted orange. The wealthy summoned private fire departments. The poor found their emergency alerts delayed by hours. Of the 88 cities that make up Los Angeles County, 39 have the official designation Very High Fire Hazard Severity Zones. From the 405, the whole place in flames. At a distance, what appears a cinematic apocalypse or dystopian war is up close, a bunch of eyes stinging, lungs infected, lives disrupted, homeless displaced, memories destroyed, children terrorized, parents helpless, and then distracted by calls to inept insurance companies. The air was toxic, the ground a heap of rubble growing larger. 9 p.m., 20,000 acres burning. 8 a.m., 22,000 acres burning. 4 p.m., 24,000 acres burning. Next photo is a copy of Olivia Nuzzi's book, American Canto, which was released December 2nd and is Nuzzi's first book. Shots rang out. The story of the relationship had broken, the bullet metaphorical. My phone rang again. I need you to take a bullet for me, the politician said. Please. It was the flag. When I close my eyes in search of the end or the start, the place at which before stopped and beyond which now began, that is what I see. The blur of colors, the flash of red, of blue, of white, stretched and folded, pulled apart, undefined yet unmistakable, the flag. There was no one day, one moment, one event, one decision, one word that marked the change. There was the flag as it mutated from metaphorical to literal weapon, as it was marred by a corruption of the American character that could not be understood or even fully observed through the prism of the partisan binary, which is to say that it was the flag, but it was not about the flag, not about notions of patriotism or nationalism or idolatry. It was the flag that thrashed in psychedelic distress, suggested a bend in lanes of reason, a tear in the fabric of consensus reality. In this period of now, from 2015 to 2025, in which the man through whom the culture was synthesized achieved dominance, I found myself fixated on the flag, on the way the flag expressed how the country was warping, and yet the magnitude of this change could not be categorized appropriately or cataloged completely amid such amnesia. At the southern border, or the White House, or the Midwestern auto factory, or the boat in the Atlantic, or the truck rolling beside the Pacific, the very flag that had been clutched like pearls at the turn of the century was refashioned as costume jewelry. Red, white, and blue, asphyxiated blue, gray, and black. Stars and stripes, a backdrop for the star of the country. One stripe remade a banner across which his campaign slogan crawled. That it looked so unserious, the manner in which the symbol of a country was seized and perverted in violation of code and good taste to communicate tribal allegiances, at once camp and seditious, was a sleight of hand. That those who did not participate in the process by which it was edited or did not dwell in places where such flags were flown were not inclined to be offended by the sight of them, prevented their inclusion in the broader culture wars. Yet even the flags, about which nothing seemed amiss, were tricks of a kind, most of them made of plastic parts imported from a foreign adversary and assembled by low-wage immigrant workers and offered for pennies wholesale to mega-chains that advertised them as made in America, at markups of 15,000%. As the edited flags waved strange and ominous, my job was to bear witness to the processes of American presidential politics, to travel the country and attempt to understand those who sought or wielded or influenced executive power. I had never been interested in politics exactly. I was interested in characters. And as it happened, there were lots of them in politics. And like all great characters, they wanted something, would do whatever they had to in order to get it. And often they were delusional. But often enough to encourage delusion, delusions manifested in America. Almost as soon as I entered the profession, I was assigned to cover the dominant force, the president, the greatest character of all. I came to see him as the mirror through which the country was reflected back at itself. The mistake was to think it possible to opt out of the picture he revealed. Those who tried found his concave surface made light into flame, that the heat warped even that which the flame did not burn, as the field of his distortion sprawled ever wider, its imperial expansion across territories, not a hostile takeover, but a series of terms and conditions to which we had repeatedly and emphatically agreed. We were primed to participate in the farcical parable in which the son of a businessman dreams of making movies, goes to Hollywood, comes home, becomes a businessman who thinks still of the screen, thinks of Hollywood, who makes himself a star as consolation, becomes the skilled practitioner of a screen art that perverts notions of truth and make-believe, who, like many stars, succumbs to tyrannical impulses and authoritarian fantasies, because the compromise of his life feels like a loss of control, an expression of weakness, because it is, and whose fantasies, in a pretty good twist, are not his alone, but are instead woven into a mass delirium that splits us into a Gemini nation under a Gemini ruler. Everything seemed suddenly flexible. With all information available at all times to all people, all matters appeared potentially negotiable. Fine fractures splintered deep, fanned out far, cracked up for good. The parties were over. The system was moot. Vast interconnectedness and mass overstimulation gave way to individual isolation and nihilistic boredom, so total that it all but invited the ascendant mob mentality politics of comic relief and sadistic catharsis. Our more flammable world, arson, the national pastime, self-immolation, well. Events lost context, words lost meaning, denier. Nothing could be believed because everything was subject to change. Truther, everything could be believed because anything was possible. This was at once inspirational slogan and active threat. I am talking, of course, about how it happened between me and the politician. I am talking, of course, about how it happened between the country and the president. I cannot talk about one without the other. The man who cried dictator yesterday might be his deputy tomorrow. The man who condemned the violence might soon tell you there had been no violence at all. The woman might make official her concession, but then refuse to concede the point. The man might refuse all concessions, and for his more total commitment to his truth, be rewarded with a prophecy fulfilled. A promise was only a suggestion. A suggestion was only a joke, unless you were not moved to laugh. Then the joke was on you. In this reality, reality ceased to feel real. In the news, the politician offers a united front and a rewritten history. My vow of silence does not feel like enough. I wish to fall silent on myself, too. I wish to sink into the sea, to flee behind the curve of the earth, to emerge a new shape, a stranger, to stop giving fake names in coffee shops, to never see myself, the character of myself imagined by others, viral allegory of hubris, female avatar of Icarus, stripped and left for dead in a pool of wax. I do not wish to be understood, which no one seems to understand. Birds of prey circle. It is inconceivable, it seems, that someone would choose to allow a crisis to go to waste, would not want to make of their attention more attention, would not want to reap some kind of short-term profit from the mess of their life. The paparazzi, the escalating ones, write to tell me where their colleagues are staking me out. New York, Washington, outside my brother's house, where they get into an altercation with a neighbor. Never anywhere I am. They think that if they do me this favor, I will cut a deal and agree to be photographed by them in exchange for what they advertise as control over my image. My image, a ship that has sailed and sunk. The offer includes a promise that doubles as a threat. If I accept their terms, I will be left alone the rest of the time, which means that if I do not accept their terms, I will not be left alone. They are outside my parents' house, one of them said. I ask him to let me know if he finds my parents. I have been looking for them for years. For the first time in a while, I feel with some frequency grief's phantom limb. I should call my mother. I should see my father. I am always forgetting to do something. That is how their absence registers. Was I not somebody's daughter? Did I not mean to check in today? I vow to call more often in my next life. In the discourse, someone I have met before jokes about my murder. Others contact me to warn me that such a thing is not a joke but a possibility. I was not going to sleep anyhow. People often people I do not know very well, reach out to tell me that I have appeared in their dreams. I wonder if this is because I sleep so little. If the version of me who lives on the plane of dreams tires of waiting for me to release her to action, if she goes out searching for places where she may exist without my permission, if she identifies the minds of those who have felt any kindness toward me, if she thinks that within their dreams she might get to live freely instead. I wonder, too, if this is a function of being a visible face but a veiled personality. If my impression contains empty space that renders me an adaptable idea, and thus a useful device for subconscious minds. It is nice to think of this, that I might still be in some way, to someone, of use. I mean to tell you as best as I can what it was to face this unrealness, to stand so close that it seemed at times almost plausible, to tiptoe along the edge of the abyss, and to balance there just long enough to forget that the plates would soon shift. I mean to tell you of the canyon where voices carried, the place where monsters spoke to me. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection from the CD Peaceful Christmas from Regency Music in Nashville, Tennessee.